Finally, after a year of nightmares, she had her life back. It took her more than an hour to reach the small, beautiful Beverly Hills office building that she'd leased for more than 7 years. She parked in her spot and went inside, closing the door quietly behind her. On the second floor, she paused outside her office, looking at the sterling silver plaque on the door. Dr. Julia Cates. She pressed the intercom button.
Dr. Cates's office,
came the scratchy-voiced reply through the speaker.
May I help you?
Hey, Gwen, it's me.
Oh!
There was a buzzing sound, then the door eased open with a click. Julia took a deep breath and opened it. The office smelled of the fresh flowers that were delivered every Monday morning. Though there were fewer patients now, she'd never cut back on the flower order. It would have been a sign of defeat. Hello, doctor, said Gwen Connolly, her receptionist. Congratulations on yesterday. Thanks, she smiled. Is Melissa here yet?
You have no appointments this week, Gwen said gently.
The compassion in her brown eyes was unnerving.
They all canceled.
All of them? Even Marcus?
Did you see the L.A. Times today?
No. Why? Gwen pulled a newspaper out of the trash can and dropped it on the desk. The headline was, Dead Wrong. Beneath it was a photograph of Julia.
The Zunigas gave an interview after the hearing. They blamed you for all of it.
Julia reached out for the wall to steady herself.
I'm sure they're just trying to get out from under the lawsuit. They said you should have committed their daughter.
Oh. The words slipped out on a breath. Gwen stood up and came around the desk. She was a small, compact woman who had run this office as she'd run her home, with discipline and caring. Moving forward, she opened her arms.
You helped a lot of people. No one can take that from you.
Julia sidestepped quickly. If she were touched right now, she'd fall apart. She might never put all the pieces back together. Gwen stopped.
It's not your fault.
Thank you. I guess I'll take a vacation. She tried to smile. It felt heavy and wooden on her face. I haven't gone anywhere in years.
It'd be good for you.
Yes.
I'll cancel the flowers and call the building manager, Gwen said. Let him know you'll be gone for a while.
I'll cancel the flowers.
Funny how that, of all of it, broke the skin.
Julia held onto her composure by the thinnest strand as she moved Gwen toward the door and said goodbye. Then, alone in the office, she sank to her knees on the expensive carpeting and bowed her head. She wasn't sure how long she knelt there in the darkness, listening to the strains of her own breathing and the beating of her heart. Finally, she got awkwardly to her feet and looked around, wondering what she would do next. This practice was the very heart of her. In her pursuit of professional excellence, she'd put everything else on the back burner. Friends, family, hobbies. She hadn't even had a date in almost a year. Not since Philip, in fact. She went to her phone and stood there, staring down at the speed dial list. Dr. Philip Westover was still number 7. She felt an ache of need, a bone-deep desire to hear his voice, hear him say, "It'll be okay, Julia," in that lilting brogue of his. For 5 years, he'd been her best friend and her lover. Now, he was another woman's husband. That was the thing about love. It was unreliable. With a sigh, she pushed the number 2 button. Her therapist, Dr. Harold Collins, answered on the second ring. She'd been seeing him once a month since her residency, when it had been required of all psychiatric students. In truth, he'd been more of a friend than a doctor.
Hey, Harry, she said, leaning tiredly against the wall. Did you see this morning's paper? He sighed heavily.
Julia, I've been worried about you.
I'm worried about myself.
You need to start giving interviews. Tell your side of the story. It's ridiculous to shoulder the whole blame for this thing. We all think...
What's the point? They'll believe what they want to anyway. You know that.
Sometimes fighting is the point, Julia.
I've never been good at that, Harry. She stared out the window at the bright blue-skied day and wondered what she would do now. They talked for a while longer, but in truth, Julia wasn't listening. Treating patients was all she had, all she was good at. She should have built herself a life instead of just a career. If she had, she wouldn't be alone now. And talking about her emptiness wouldn't help. She'd been wrong to reach out. I better go, Harry. Thanks for everything.
Julia.
She hung up the phone and walked around her office. When she felt tears gathering again, she stripped out of her suit and put on her workout clothes, then headed to the treadmill she kept in the next room. She knew she'd been on it too much lately, that she'd lost so much weight she was down to nothing, but she couldn't seem to stop. Staring into the murky darkness of her beloved office, she stepped on the black pad and set the incline button for hills. When she was running, she almost forgot her pain. It wasn't until much later, when she turned the machine off and driven back to her too quiet home, that she thought about what it meant to run and run and have nowhere to go. In these late evening hours, the halls of the county hospital were quiet. It was Max's least favorite time. He preferred the hustle and bustle of daily emergencies. There were too many thoughts that waited for him in the shadowy quiet. He made a few last notes on the girl's chart, then looked down at her. She lay perfectly still, breathing in the deep, even way of sedated sleep. On her left wrist, the brown leather restraint looked obscenely heavy and ugly. He reached down for her free hand, picked it up, and held it. Her fingers, clean now but still stained by blood and lined with scars, were thin and tiny against his palm. "Who are you, little one?" Behind him, the door opened and closed. He knew without looking that it was Trudy Hightower, the charge nurse of the swing shift. He could smell her perfume. Gardenias. "How is she?" Trudy asked, coming up close to him. She was a tall, good-looking woman with kind eyes and a loud voice. She claimed that the voice had come from raising three boys on her own. "Not good." She made a tisking sound. "The poor thing. Are we ready to move her? The old daycare center is all set up." She reached down and unhooked the restraint. When she lifted the heavy strap, Max touched her wrist. "Leave it here," he said. "But I think she's been bound enough in her life." He bent down and scooped the sleeping child up in his arms. In silence, they walked down the brightly lit hallways to the old daycare center. There, he tucked the girl into the hospital bed they'd moved into the room. At the last second, he had to stop himself from whispering, "Sleep tight, kiddo." "I'll stay with her a while," he said instead. Trudy touched his forearm gently. "I'm off in 40 minutes, she said. "You want to come over to the house?" He nodded. God knew he could use a distraction. Tonight, if he went home alone, the memories would be there, waiting to keep him company. Ellie stared at the computer screen until the letters blurred into little black blobs on a field of throbbing white. A headache opened its parachute at the back of her skull and floated down her spine. If she read one more report of a missing or abducted child, she was going to scream. There were thousands of them. Thousands! Lost girls who had no voice to cry for help, no way to reach out. The few who were lucky enough to be alive somewhere were counting on professionals to find and save them.
Ellie closed her eyes. There had to be more she could do. But what? She'd already done everything she could think of. She and the town's other two officers had canvassed the streets. They'd notified the county sheriff's office that an unidentified child had been found. They'd also contacted the Family Crisis Network and Rural Resources, as well as every state and national agency. No one knew who the kid was. And it was becoming increasingly clear that this was Rain Valley's case. Her case. Other law enforcement and social agencies might be called upon to help, but the child had shown up in this town. And that made identifying the girl her job. The county sheriff had backed away so fast he'd practically left skid marks. His, "Sorry, she's on city property," told Ellie plenty. No one would take responsibility for this girl until a positive ID was made. She pushed away from the desk and got to her feet. Arching her back, she kneaded her aching neck. She stepped over her sleeping dogs and went to the porch, looking out across her backyard. It was almost dawn. Here, on the edge of the rainforest, the world was both utterly still and deeply alive. As always, there was moisture everywhere. Wet air blew in from the ocean and left millions of dew beads on the leaves. Come dawn, those drops would fall soundlessly to the ground. Invisible rain, her dad had called it, and Ellie always listened for it, if only to remember him. "I wish you were here, Dad," she said, slipping her feet into the fleece-lined clogs by the back door. "You and Uncle Joe always knew how to run with the big dogs." She crossed the porch and went down the back steps, then through the pink and violet morning toward the river. Mist coiled around her feet, rose up from the dark grass in vapors. She was at the very edge of her property, standing by her dad's favorite Fall River fishing hole, when she realized why she was here. His house was on the other side of the river and across a marshy field. From this distance, it looked no bigger than a tool shed, but she knew better. As a kid, she'd hiked through this field every day and played in that yard. For a minute, she almost started for it. She had the idea to toss stones at his window again and call out to him. He would listen to her fears and understand them. He always had. But those days were more than 2 decades old. Lisa certainly didn't want to be wakened at dawn by the sound of stones hitting her bedroom window. And though Cal would answer and sit outside with her, she was his boss, not just his friend, he wouldn't really be listening. He had his own life now, his own wife and children. And even though everyone knew that Lisa wasn't good enough for him, he loved his family. Ellie knew she was on her own. She turned and went back to her house. With a tired sigh, she sat back down at her desk and pulled up the missing children reports. The answer had to be in here. It had to be. It was her last thought before falling asleep. She was wakened by a car horn. She came awake with a start, realizing all at once that she'd fallen asleep at her computer. Shit! She stumbled to her feet and went to the front door. Peanut stood in the yard, waving goodbye to her husband as he drove away. Ellie looked down at her watch. It was 7:55 in the morning. "What in the hell are you doing here?" she said in a voice that sounded like she smoked a pack a day.
"I heard you tell Max you'd meet him at 8 at the hospital. You're going to be late."
"I didn't invite you to join us."
"I figured it was an oversight. Now hustle your ass."
Ellie fished the car keys out of her pocket and tossed them to Peanut, then went back into the house. There was no time to shower, and no reason to change her clothes since she was still in her uniform. So she brushed her teeth, took off last night's makeup, and put on some new layers. In the kitchen, she took out a package of pork chops. Of course, there were 2 of them. No wonder she had to spend so much time exercising. Life came in twin packs. It wasn't exactly a help to the single woman. She put the package on a paper towel in the refrigerator to thaw.
It was 8 on the dot when she got into her cruiser. Peanut had turned the stereo on and put in an Aerosmith CD. Ellie snapped off the music.
It's too early for that.
You were up all night?
How can you tell?
You have a keyboard imprint on your cheek. Ellie touched her cheek.
Shit, is it noticeable?
Honey, you could see it from space, Peanut laughed, then sobered. Did you find anything useful?
I was online all night and called every precinct in 5 counties. No one has reported a missing girl in the area. Not lately, anyway. If we have to go national in the search, it means going through the files of all the girls reported missing in the past few years.
At the thought of that, they both fell silent. Ellie was trying to think of something ordinary to say when she turned into the hospital's parking lot and saw the crowd gathered at the front door.
Damn it! They're turning this into a circus.
Ellie parked in a visitor's spot, grabbed her notebook, and got out of the car. Peanut followed in an uncharacteristic silence. Like geese, the crowd surged into formation and flew at her. The Grimm sisters, Daisy, Marigold, and Violet, led the charge. As identical as prongs on a fork, the three old ladies matched each other step for step. Daisy, the eldest, was the first to speak. As always, she clutched an old black urn that held her late husband's ashes.
"We've come for word of the child."
"Who is the poor dear?"
Violet demanded, squinting up through scratched glasses.
"Can she truly fly like a bird?"
Marigold asked.
"Or jump like a cat?"
This came from someone in the back. Ellie had to remind herself that these people were her constituents. More than that, they were her friends and neighbors.
"We don't have any answers yet. I'll let you all know when we do. For now, I could use your help."
"Anything," Marigold said, pulling a flower-spangled notebook out of her purple vinyl handbag.
Violet offered her sister a tulip pen.
"The child will need clothes and such. Maybe a stuffed animal or two to keep her company," Ellie said.
Before she'd even finished, the Grimm sisters had taken over. The three ex-teachers corralled the group and started delegating tasks. Ellie and Peanut left the crowd. Together, they walked up the concrete path to the hospital's glass doors. The sliders whooshed open.
"Hey, Ellie," said the receptionist at their approach. "Dr. Saracen is waiting for you at the old daycare center."
"Thanks,"
Ellie said. She and Peanut didn't speak as they walked down the hallway and into the elevator. On the second floor, they went past the X-ray room and turned left. The last room on the right had once been a daycare center for employees. It had been designated and designed years ago when the city coffers were full. In the time since the spotted owl and the dwindling salmon runs and the protection of old-growth forests, those accounts had grown too thin to support luxuries like daycare. The room had been empty and unmanned for more than 2 years. Max stood in the hallway with his arms crossed. Fluorescent lighting tangled in his hair and made his ever-present tan look faded. She hadn't seen him look this bad since the time he fell 40 feet down some mountain. Then he'd had 2 black eyes and a split lip. At their approach, he looked up and waved, but didn't bother smiling. He moved sideways to make room for them at the window. The room beyond was small and rectangular, with red and yellow color-blocked walls and cubbyholes full of toys and games and books. A sink and counter took up one corner, used years ago, no doubt, for art projects and daily cleanup. Several small tables, surrounded by even smaller chairs, filled the center of the room. Along the left wall were a single hospital bed and several empty cribs. There were 2 windows in the room, the one in front of them, and a second, smaller one, which overlooked the rear parking lot. To their left, a locked metal door was the only entrance. Ellie sidled close, letting her shoulder touch his arm.
"Talk to me, Max,"
Last night, after we finished the testing, we diapered her and tucked her into the bed. This morning, when she woke up, she went crazy. There's no other word for it. Crazy. Screaming, shrieking, throwing herself to the floor. She broke every lamp and smashed the mirror over the sink. When we tried to give her another injection, she bit Carol Rentz hard enough to draw blood, then hid under the bed. She's been there almost an hour. Do you have an ID on her yet? Ellie shook her head, then turned to Peanut.
Why don't you go to the cafeteria? Get kid food for her.
Sure, send the fat girl for food.
Peanut sighed dramatically, but couldn't help smiling. She loved to be a part of things. When she'd gone, Max said to Ellie, I don't know what to tell you, Ellie. I've never seen a case like this.
Tell me what you do know.
Well, I think she's probably about 6 years old.
But she's so small.
Malnourished. Plus, she's had no dental or medical care, and her body is pretty scarred up.
Scarred?
Little things, mostly, although there's one that looks more serious. On her left shoulder, maybe an old knife wound.
Jesus.
I drew blood and swabbed her mouth for DNA. If it were up to me, she'd still be sedated for hydration, but you wanted a diagnosis.
Has she spoken?
No, but her vocal cords look unimpaired. I'd say, and this is just a guess, that she is physically able to speak, but I can't tell if she knows how.
She doesn't know how to speak? What are you saying?
All I know is that her screams are unintelligible. I recorded it. There were no recognizable words. Her brain waves show no anomalies. She could well be deaf, or mentally challenged, or severely developmentally delayed, or autistic. I can't be sure. I'm not even sure I know what tests to run for her mental state.
What should we do?
Find out who she is.
Gee, thanks. I meant right now.
He nodded toward Peanut, who was coming toward them with a tray of food. That's a good start. Ellie looked down at what P had chosen. A stack of pancakes, a pair of fried eggs, a waffle with strawberries and whipped cream, and a glass of milk. It made Ellie hungry. Max said, I'll get an orderly to crawl under the bed and get her.
Just leave it on the table, Peanut said. She might be odd, but she's a kid. They do things in their own way and their own time. Hell, you can't make a 2-year-old eat, and they're tiny.
Ellie smiled at her friend.
Any other advice?
No more strangers. She knows you, so you should take the food in. Talk to her in a soothing voice, but don't stay. Maybe she wants to be alone to eat.
Thanks.
Taking the tray, Ellie went into the brightly painted room. The metal door clicked shut behind her.
Hey, little one. It's me again. I hope you don't hold that whole net thing against me.
She moved cautiously forward and set the tray on one of the tables. At the movement, the keys on her belt jingled. She clamped her hand over them.
I thought you might be hungry.
Under the bed, the girl made a growling sound. It made the hairs on the back of Ellie's neck stand up. She tried to think of just the right thing to say, but nothing came to her. So she backed out of the room and closed the door behind her. The lock clicked loudly into place. In the hall again, Ellie stood by Max at the window.
Will she eat it?
He opened the girl's chart and got out his pen. I guess we'll find out. In silence, they stood there, looking through the glass at the room that appeared empty. Several minutes later, a tiny hand came out from underneath the bed. Peanut gasped.
Looky there!
More time passed. Finally, a dark head appeared. Slowly, the child crawled out from her hiding place on all fours. When she looked up at the glass and saw them standing there, her nostrils flared. Then she dashed to the table, where she froze again, and bent low over the food, sniffing it suspiciously. She threw the whipped cream to the floor, then ate the pancakes and the eggs. She didn't seem to know what to make of the waffles and syrup, Ignoring both, she grabbed the strawberries and took them back to her hiding place under the bed. The whole incident took less than a minute.
"And I thought my kids had bad table manners," Peanut said. "She eats like a wild animal."
"We need a specialist," Max said quietly.
"I've contacted the authorities," Ellie answered, "the state, the FBI, and the Center for Missing and Exploited Children. They all need an identity or a crime to get in the action. I don't know how to find out her identity if she won't talk."
"Not that kind of specialist. She needs a psychiatrist."
Peanut drew in a sharp breath.
"I can't believe we didn't think of it. She'd be perfect."
Max frowned.
"Who?"
Ellie looked at Peanut.
"She'd never do it. Her clients pay $200 an hour.
That was before. She can't have many patients left.
God knows she's qualified for this," Ellie said.
"Who in the hell are you two talking about?" Max asked.
Ellie finally looked at him.
"My sister is Julia Cates."
"The shrink who..."
"Yeah, that one."
She turned to Peanut.
"Let's go. I'll call her from the office."
In the past 12 hours, Julia had begun at least a dozen projects. She tried organizing her closet, rearranging her furniture, scrubbing her refrigerator, and deep cleaning her bathrooms. She'd also gone to the nursery to buy autumn plants and to Home Depot for a deck stain and paint stripper. It was a good time to do all of the projects she'd been putting off for 10 years. The problem was her hands. She was fine when she started a project, more than fine. She was optimistic. Unfortunately, her optimism was as thin as an eggshell. All it took was a thought. It's time for Joe's appointment, or, worse yet, Amber's. And her hands would start to shake. She'd feel herself go cold. No temperature setting was high enough to keep her warm. Late last night, in the deepest hour of darkness, when the traffic behind her condo had dwindled to a drone as faded as a single mosquito's flight, and the mighty Pacific Ocean out front had whooshed steadily toward the golden sand, she'd even tried to write a book. Why not? Every pseudo-famous person went that route these days. And she wanted to tell her side of the story. Maybe she even needed to. She'd slipped out of her comfortable queen-sized bed and dressed in fleece sweats and UGG boots, then gone out onto her small deck. From her place on the 6th floor, the midnight blue ocean lay before her, always in motion. Moonlight cut the sea in half, tangled in the foamy surf. Hours she'd sat there, her booted feet propped on the deck rail, her yellow pad in her lap, her pen in her hand. By midnight, she was surrounded by balled-up yellow wads of paper. All any of them said were, "I'm sorry." Somewhere around 4 o'clock, she fell into a fitful, nightmare-ridden sleep. The phone wakened her. Julia heard it as if from far away. She blinked her gritty eyes and sat up, realizing that she'd fallen asleep out on her deck. Wiping her face with one hand, she eased out of the chair and stepped over the piles of balled-up paper. At the phone, she stopped. The answering machine clicked on, and she heard her own voice say, cheerily,
"You've reached Dr. Julia Cates. If this is a medical emergency, hang up and call 911. If not, please leave a message, and I'll get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks, and goodbye."
There was a long beep. Julia tensed. In the last months, most of her calls had come from reporters and victims' families and straight-out kooks.
"Hey, Jules, it's me, your big sis. It's important."
Julia picked up the phone. "Hey, El." There was an awkward pause. But wasn't that always the way it was between them? Though they were sisters, they were 4 years apart in age and light years apart in personality. Everything about Ellie was larger than life. Her voice, her personality, her passions. Julia always felt colorless beside her flamboyant, Miss Popular sister.
"Are you okay?"
Ellie finally asked.
Fine, thanks.
You got released from the lawsuit. That's a good thing.
Yeah. There was another awkward pause, and then Julia said, thanks for calling, but...
Look, I need a favor.
A favor?
There's a situation up here. You could really help us out.
You don't have to do it anymore, Ellie. I'm fine.
Do what?
Try to save me. I'm a big girl now.
I never tried to save you.
Yeah, right. How about when you got Todd Eldred's little brother to ask me to the prom? Or when you brought all of your popular friends to my 16th birthday party?
Oh, that. Mom made me do all that stuff.
Do you think I don't know that? None of your friends even talked to me at the party. And don't get me wrong, I appreciated it. Then and now. But it's not necessary. I'll be fine.
I thought you said you were fine.
Julia was surprised by the perceptiveness of her sister's question. Don't worry about me, Elle. Really.
For a shrink, you're a shitty listener. I'm telling you, I need you in Rain Valley. Specifically, I need a child psychiatrist.
You're older than I usually take.
Very funny. Will you fly up here? And I mean, right now.
There was a pause, a rustling of paper on the other end of the line.
Alaska has a flight in 2 hours, another one in three. I can have a ticket waiting for you.
Julia frowned. This didn't sound like the ordinary super-sister-saving-loser-sister scenario that had set like concrete in their school years. Tell me what's going on.
There isn't time. I want you to catch the 10:15 flight. Will you trust me?
Julia glanced out the huge floor-to-ceiling windows and tried to focus on the blue Pacific Ocean. But all she could really see were the yellow balls of paper that cluttered the deck floor.
Jules? Please?
Why not? Julia finally said. She had nothing better to do. 4. Julia hadn't been back to Rain Valley in years. And now she was returning on the wave of failure. Perhaps she should have stayed in L.A. after all. There she would have disappeared. Here she would always be the other Kate's girl. You know, the weird one. When a girl grew up in the shadow of the homecoming queen, there were two possible choices. Disappear or make your own reputation. Unfortunately, when you were the tall, scarecrow-thin bookworm in a beloved, gregarious, larger-than-life family, there was no way to do either. From early on, she'd been the square peg, the kid who mediated every playground dispute, but never joined in any of the games, the last kid picked for every sport, the girl at home reading during the senior prom. She was, or had been, that rarest of birds in a small blue-collar town, a loner. Only her mother had believed in a bright future for Julia. In fact, she'd encouraged her daughter to dream big. Unfortunately, her mother hadn't lived to see Julia's med school graduation. That loss had always been a sliver under Julia's skin, a phantom pain that came and went. The closer she got to Rain Valley, the more it was likely to hurt. She stared out the plane's small window. Everything was gray, as if a cloud artist had painted the merest of washes over the green landscape. It made her feel lonely, all that gray, as if she too might disappear again in the Washington mist. The four white-capped volcanoes that stretched from northern Oregon to Bellingham looked like the spine of some mythic sleeping beast. She heard the passenger behind her draw in a sharp breath and murmur, "Look, Fred! At that! Is it Rainier?" Suddenly she was thinking about the Zunigas and those lost children. Dead wrong. It didn't surprise her. In the past year, everything, every thought and deed, led her back to regret. Don't think about that. She closed her eyes and concentrated on her breathing until the emotions subsided. By the time the plane landed, she was okay again. She grabbed her bag from the overhead bin and merged into the line of passengers exiting the plane. She was almost to the exit door when it happened. One of the flight attendants recognized her. There was no mistaking the signs, the widening of the eyes, the slowly opening mouth. As Julia passed, she heard the woman whisper, "It's her, that doctor, the one who..." She kept moving. By the end of the jetway, she was almost running. She caught a glimpse of Ellie standing amid the crowd, dressed in her blue uniform, looking stunningly beautiful. Julia knew she should stop, say hello, and pretend everything was all right. That was the smart thing to do, the fine thing. She kept moving, running. She raced across the crowded concourse hallway toward the ladies' restroom sign. Ducking in, she disappeared into one of the stalls and slammed the door shut, then sat down on the toilet. "Calm down, Jules. Breathe." "Are you in here, Julia?" Ellie sounded out of breath and irritated. Julia released a slow, shaking breath. Having a panic attack was bad. Having one in front of her sister was almost unbearable. She got slowly to her feet and opened the door. "I'm here." Ellie put her hands on her hips and stared at her. It was a cop assessing the situation look. "I haven't seen an airport sprint like that since the OJ commercials." "I had to go to the bathroom." "You should see a urologist." "It's not that. Julia felt like an idiot. The flight attendant recognized me. She looked at me as if I killed those kids. She felt her cheeks heat up, knowing she should say more, explain. But her sister couldn't understand a thing like this. Ellie was like one of those pioneer wives who could give birth in the field and go back to work. Her sister knew little about being fragile. Ellie's hard look softened. "Fuck 'em all. You can't let it get to you." Julia wished she could do that, but she'd always needed to be accepted. As a shrink, she knew the hows and whys of her need, how her popular in-the-spotlight family had somehow made her feel marginalized and unimportant, how her father's withheld love had made her believe she was unlovable. But knowledge didn't soften the need. She wasn't even sure how it had come to matter so much. All she knew was that her profession, her ability to help people, had filled the frightened place inside of her with joy. And now she was scared again. "It's not that easy for me. You can't understand." Ellie leaned against the pale green tile wall. "Because you think I'm only slightly smarter than an earthworm? Or because I have nothing in my life worth losing?" Julia wished suddenly that she had a better memory reservoir. Surely there were times when they'd played together, she and Ellie, when they'd counted secrets instead of slights, when laughter had followed their conversations instead of awkward pauses. But if all that had happened, Julia didn't recall it. What she remembered was being the smart sister, the weird one, who grew too tall in a petite family and wanted things no one else understood. The mushroom in a family of orchids. She'd always been able to say the right things to strangers, but the wrong thing to her sister. She sighed. "Let's not do this, Elle." "You're right. Come on." Before Julia could answer, Ellie headed out of the bathroom. Julia had no choice but to follow. At the car, an ugly white Suburban with wood-grained door panels, Ellie stopped at the back door just long enough to toss her purse in, then she strode around to the driver's side. Julia struggled with her suitcase. It took her two tries to stow it. She slammed the back door shut, then went to the passenger side and climbed into the front seat. Ellie backed the car out of the stall and headed for the exit. The minute the engine roared to life, the stereo came on. Some guy with a twangy voice was singing about the pocket of a clown. Neither one of them said anything. As the landscape changed, going from city gray to country green, Julia began to feel like an idiot for sparring with her sister. How was it that even after all these distant and separate years, they immediately fell into their childhood roles? One look at each other, and they were adolescents again. They were family, as specious as that connection sometimes felt, and they ought to be able to get along. Besides, she was a psychiatrist, for God's sake, a specialist in interpersonal dynamics, and here she was acting like the younger sister who wasn't invited to play with the big kids. "Why don't you tell me why I'm here?" she finally said.
"I'll tell you at the house. I have a lot of photographs to show you. I'm afraid you won't believe me otherwise."
Julia glanced at her. "So it is a rescue mission. There's no real reason I'm here."
"Oh, there's a reason. We have a little girl who needs help, but it's complicated."
Julia didn't know if she believed that, but she knew that Ellie did things in her own way and in her own time. There was no point in asking further questions. The better course of action was a neutral topic, small talk. "How's your friend Penelope?"
"She's good. Raising teenagers is killing her, though."
Ellie immediately winced, as if realizing she shouldn't have paired teenager and killing in the same sentence.
"Sorry."
"Don't sweat it, Elle. Teenagers are difficult. How old are they?"
"A 14-year-old boy and a 16-year-old girl."
"Tough ages." Ellie smiled.
"The girl, Tara, keeps wanting to pierce body parts and get tattoos. It's making P's husband insane."
"And Penelope, how's she handling it?"
"Great. Well, unless you consider her weight gain. In the past year, she's gone on every diet known to man. Last week, she started smoking. She says it's how the stars do it."
"That and throwing up," Julia said. Ellie nodded.
"How's Philip?"
Julia was surprised by the swift pain that came with his name. If only she could say, "He stopped loving me." Maybe Ellie could get her to laugh about her broken heart. As a shrink, she knew it would be a good move, that kind of honesty. It might open a door that had been closed for most of their lives. Instead, she said, "We broke up last year. I'm too busy. I mean, I was too busy for love." Ellie laughed at that.
"Too busy for love? Are you crazy?"
For the next 2 hours, they alternated between meaningless conversation and meaningful silences. Julia worked hard to find questions that brought them together and stayed away from answers that caused separation. They barely mentioned their father and stayed away from memories of Mom. They came to the Rain Valley exit and turned off the highway. On the long, winding forest road that led to childhood, Julia found herself tensing up. Here, amidst the towering trees, she started to feel small again, insignificant.
"I was going to sell the place, move closer to town, but every time I get close to listing it, I find another repair that needs to be done,"
Ellie said on the way out of town.
"I don't need a shrink to tell me I'm afraid to leave it."
"It's just a house, Elle."
"I guess that's how we're different, Jules. To you, it's 3 bedrooms, 2 baths, and a kitchen dining living room. To me, it's the best childhood ever. It's where I caught dragonflies in a glass jar and let my little sister braid my hair with flowers."
Her voice dropped a little. She gave Julia a meaningful look, then turned onto their driveway.
"It's where my parents loved each other for almost 3 decades.
Julia wouldn't let herself disagree with that, although they both knew it was a lie, a fable. "So, quit threatening to sell it. Admit that it's where you want to be. Hand the memories down to your own kids."
"As you may have noticed, I don't have kids, but thanks for pointing it out."
Ellie drove into the yard and stopped hard.
"We're here."
Julia realized she had said the wrong thing again. "You don't need a husband, you know. Especially not the kind you pick," she said. "You can have a baby on your own." Ellie turned to look at her.
"That might be how it is in the big city. But not here. And not for me. I want it all. The husband, the baby, the golden retriever. She smiled. Actually, I've got the dogs. And I'd appreciate it if you didn't mention my husband's again.
Julia nodded. Time to change the subject. So, how are Jake and Elwood? Still go straight for a girl's crotch?
They're males, aren't they?
Ellie smiled, and Julia was struck by how beautiful her sister still was. Though Ellie was 39 years old, there wasn't a line around her eyes or a pleating of skin around her mouth. Those startling green eyes shone against the milky purity of her skin. She had strong cheekbones and full, sensuous lips. Even her small-town, poorly layered haircut couldn't dim her beauty. She was petite and surprisingly curvy, with a smile like a halogen spotlight. No wonder everyone loved her. Come on. Ellie got out of the Suburban and slammed the door shut behind her. Julia meant to move. Instead, she sat there, looking through the dirty windshield at the house in which she'd grown up. The late afternoon sunlight made everything appear golden and impossibly softened, except for the fringe of dark green trees. This was only the second time she'd been back since her mother's funeral. Then she'd stayed only as long as she absolutely had to. Medical school had provided an excellent excuse. She'd said, "I have to get back for tests," and no one questioned her. In retrospect, she should have stayed. That time might have built a bridge between her and her sister, given them a common ground. As it was, however, the opposite had occurred. They had moved through the shoulder-to-shoulder crowd separately. No one in Rain Valley had known what to say to Julia in good times. In bad, they were even more confused. All they'd said over and over again was how proud her mother had been of Julia's education. By the third mention of it, Julia couldn't stop crying. It hadn't helped to see how much comfort Ellie got from her friends, while she had stood alone all night, waiting for her father's attention to turn her way. Of course, she'd been disappointed. He'd been the star that night, the widower laid low by grief. Everyone held him, kissed his cheek, and promised that Brenda was in a better place. Only Julia seemed to see the lie in all of it, the act. When at last her father broke down and wept, everyone except Julia rushed to comfort him. She had seen, even as a child, what no one else, especially Ellie, ever had, that her father's selfishness had crushed his wife's spirit just as he'd crushed his younger daughter's. Only Ellie had flourished in the white-hot light of her father's self-absorption. Julia reached for the door handle and wrenched it hard, then stepped down. Everything was exactly as it should be in October. Maple trees were dropping their leaves, creating that autumn song that was as familiar to her as the rushing whisper of the nearby river. She heard her mother's voice in that sound, in the falling leaves and crackling twigs and whispering wind. Softly, she whispered, "Hey, Mom." Part of her even waited for a reply. But there was only the chattering of the river and the breeze through the leaves. She followed Ellie across the marshy lawn toward the house. In the glorious light, the old house appeared to be made of hammered strips of silver. The grayed clapboards shone with 100 secret colors. White trim, peeled in places to reveal patches of wood, outlined the windows and doors. Rhododendrons the size of house trailers dotted the yard. Ellie opened the door and led the way inside. Everything looked as it always had. The same slip-covered furniture, pale beige with pink cabbage roses and faded green leaves, graced the living room. Pine antiques were everywhere. An armoire that was probably still filled with Grandma Whitaker's doilies and table linens. A dining table scarred by 3 generations of Cateses and Whitakers. A credenza that was decorated with dusty silk flowers and ceramic vases. French doors flanked a river rock fireplace. Through the silvery glass panes, a ghostly ribbon of river shone in the sunlight. Ellie hadn't changed a thing. It wasn't surprising. In Rain Valley, things and people either belonged or they didn't. If they belonged, they were loved and kept forever.
Ellie shut the door. Just as she said, "Brace yourself," two full-grown golden retrievers came thundering down the stairs. At the bottom, on the slick wooden floors, they skidded together and slid sideways, then found their footing. They barreled across the room and hit Julia like the Seahawks' front line.
"Jake! Elwood! Down!"
Ellie yelled in her best police voice. The dogs were clearly deaf. Julia gave them a giant shove and spun away. The dogs turned their lavish attention on Ellie, who threw herself into loving them. Julia watched the three of them roll around on the floor.
"Please tell me they sleep outside."
Ellie sat up, laughing, and pushed the hair out of her eyes. The dogs licked her cheeks.
"Okay, they sleep outside."
At Julia's relieved sigh, her sister said,
"Not, but I'll keep them out of your room."
"That's as good as it's going to get, I suppose."
"It is."
Ellie told the dogs to sit. On about the 12th command, they obeyed. But as soon as Ellie looked away, they started to belly crawl toward the door.
"Come on," Ellie said, leading the way to the stairs.
Julia dragged her suitcase up the narrow, creaking stairway. At the top, she turned right and followed her sister down the hallway to their childhood bedroom. A pair of twin beds, swaddled in pink chiffon, a pair of white-painted French provincial student desks with gold trim, a lime-green beanbag chair. Trolls and Barbies lined the white shelving. Dozens of blue and yellow Nancy Drews reminded her of nights spent reading with a flashlight. A faded, dusty poster of Harrison Ford as Indiana Jones was tacked to the wall. On her bed, a pair of cats lay sleeping, twined together like a French braid.
"Meet Rocky and Adrian," Ellie said as she crossed the room and scooped up the apparently boneless animals.
The cats hung lazily from her arms, yawning. She tossed them into the hallway, said,
"Go to Mommy's room,"
and then turned to Julia. "The sheets are clean. There are towels in your bathroom. The hot water still takes decades, and don't flush the toilet before you shower."
Ellie stepped closer.
"Thanks, Jules. I really appreciate your coming. I know things have been bad for you lately, and well, thanks."
Julia looked at her sister. If she'd been another kind of woman, or if they'd been different sisters, she might have admitted,
"I had nowhere to go, really." Instead, she said,
"No problem,"
and tossed her suitcase into the room. "Now, tell me why I'm here."
"Let's go downstairs. I'll need a beer for this story."
Ellie started for the stairs, then turned back to Julia.
"So will you."
Julia sat in her mother's favorite chair and listened to her sister in growing disbelief.
"She leaps from branch to branch like a cat? Come on, Elle. You're getting caught up in some country myth. It sounds like you've found an autistic child who simply wandered away from home and got lost."
"Max doesn't think it's that simple," Ellie said, sipping her beer. They'd been in the living room for the better part of an hour now. There were papers spread out across the coffee table, photographs and fingerprint smudge sheets and missing children reports.
"Who's Max?"
"He took over Doc Fisher's practice."
"He's probably just over his head with this girl.
You should have called the University of Washington. They'll have dozens of autism experts."
"Yeah, God forbid someone smart should live in Rain Valley,"
Ellie said, her voice spiking up. "You're not even listening to me." Julia made a mental note to temper her comments. "Sorry. So there's more to the story than dirty hair and prodigious tree climbing skills. Hit me."
"She won't speak. We think, Max thinks, anyway, that maybe she doesn't know how."
"That's not unusual for an autistic. They seem to operate in a different world. Often these kids..."
"You didn't see her, Jules. When she looked at me, I got chills. I've never seen such
terror in a child.
She looked at you?
Stared is more like it. I think she was trying to communicate something to me.
She made direct, purposeful eye contact?
Hello, I just said that.
It was probably nothing, or maybe Ellie had it wrong. Autistics rarely made purposeful eye contact. What about her physical mannerisms, hand movements, way of walking, that sort of thing?
She sat in that tree for hours and never moved so much as an eyelash. Think reptile stillness. When she did finally jump down, she moved with lightning speed. Daisy Grimm claims she ran like the wind, and she sniffed everything in this weird dog-like way.
In spite of herself, Julia was intrigued. She was completely soundless. Perhaps she's mute and deaf. That would also explain her getting lost. Maybe she didn't hear people calling for her.
She's not mute. She screamed and growled. Oh, yeah, and when she thought we'd killed her wolf, she howled.
Wolf?
Did I forget that part? She had a wolf pup with her. He's out at the game farm now. Floyd says he just sits at the gate and howls all day and all night.
Julia leaned back and crossed her arms. Enough was enough. This had all been a ruse, another of her sister's misguided attempts to save poor little Julia. You're making this up.
I wish I were. Unfortunately, it's all true.
She really has a wolf pup?
Yes. And are you ready for the kicker?
There's more.
She has a lot of scarring.
What kind of scarring?
Knife wounds. Maybe some whipping marks. And on her ankle, ligature-type scarring.
Julia uncrossed her arms and leaned forward. You better not be pulling my chain. This is a big deal.
I know.
Julia's mind ticked through dozens of possibilities. Autism, mental or developmental delays, early onset schizophrenia. Those were the easy, purely internal answers. But there could be something darker here, something infinitely more unique and dangerous. It could be that this child had escaped from some terrible captor. Elective mutism would be a common response to that kind of trauma. In any case, the kid would need help. And not just any psychiatrist could handle this sort of diagnosis and treatment. Only a handful of people on the West Coast specialized in this sort of thing. Fortunately, she was one of them.
She really touched me, Jules. I'm afraid that when the bigwig authorities get involved, we'll lose her. They'll warehouse her in some state institution until we find her parents. I don't think I could live with that. There's something so broken and sad about this kid. I don't know if anyone has ever fought for her. With you, we could make a case for treating her while we search. No one could deny your credentials.
And there it was, the reminder. Julia said softly, Have you been watching the news, Elle? I'm hardly at the top of anyone's list. Your state bigwigs might not be too impressed with me.
Ellie looked at her. As always, there was a directness in Ellie's eyes that was vaguely disconcerting. Her sister was one of those rare people who made up her mind easily, stuck with her decision, and fought to the end for her beliefs. Actually, it was one of the few things they had in common. Since when have I cared what other people think? You're the one we want to save this girl.
Thanks, Elle. Julia's voice was quieter than she'd expected, less certain than usual. She wished she could tell Ellie what this meant to her. Ellie nodded.
I just hope you're as good as you think you are.
I am.
Excellent. Now go take a shower and unpack. I told Max we'd meet him at the hospital before 4.
30 minutes later, Julia was showered, made up, and dressed in a well-worn pair of flare-legged jeans and a pale green cashmere sweater. She was trying not to be too excited about seeing the so-called flying wolf girl, but she couldn't quite manage her usual calm. She'd felt on the outside for so long now that even this glimpse into her old life
was enough to rev her engines. She got a Diet Coke from the fridge and sat down in the living room. Glancing at the dusty piano in the corner, she was blindsided by a memory. She saw her mom, sitting on the black bench, smoking a Virginia Slim menthol and pounding out a raucous version of that old-time rock and roll. There was a crowd of friends clustered around the piano, singing along. "Come on, girls," Mom said, waving them over. "Sing along." Julia turned her back on the piano. She didn't want to think about Mom, not yet. But here in this house, time unraveled somehow. If she stayed too long, she'd become the gawky bookworm with the bad haircut and thick glasses again. Ellie came downstairs, dressed in her blue and black uniform. The three gold stars on her collar winked in the light. Even in the bulky outfit, she looked petite and beautiful. "You ready?" Julia nodded and grabbed her purse. The few miles passed in a surprisingly companionable conversation. Julia remarked on the changes that had taken place. The stoplight, the new bridge, the closure of Hamburger Haven. Ellie pointed out how much had stayed the same. Finally, they turned a corner, and the county hospital came into view. The modest cement building was tucked at the back of a mid-sized gravel parking lot. A single ambulance was parked to the left of the emergency entrance. The two-story building was dwarfed by the bank of magnificent evergreen trees behind it. Right now, the street lamps were coming on. Every few seconds, a beam of light pulsed through the parking lot, illuminating the tiny droplets of mist that couldn't quite be called rain. The air smelled sweet and green, like freshly cut grass. As soon as they parked, Julia was out of the car. The closer she got to the door, the more confident she felt. She and Ellie walked side by side through the double doors and past the receptionist, who waved. The nurses and aides who passed her wore pale, salmon-hued uniforms that appeared to once have been bright orange. Their crepe soles made a squeaking sound on the linoleum-tiled floor. At a closed door, Ellie paused. She smoothed her clothes and tucked her hair behind her ears, then quickly checked her makeup in a hand mirror. Julia frowned. "What is this, a photo shoot?"
"You'll see."
Ellie knocked on the door. A voice said, "Come in." Ellie opened the door. They walked into a small, cramped office with a ground-level window view of a gargantuan rhododendron. He stood in the corner of the room, still as a blade of grass on a windless day, wearing faded Levi's and a black cable-knit sweater. His hair was steely gray. Not salt and pepper, either, but a perfect Richard Gere going gray all at once kind of color. He had the rugged, tanned look of a man who spent a lot of his time in the sun and the wind. But it was his eyes that caught her attention. They were searingly blue and intense. He was the best-looking man Julia had ever seen.
"You must be Dr. Cates," he said, moving toward her.
"Please call me Julia."
The smile he gave her was literally dazzling.
"Only if you'll call me Max."
She recognized instantly the kind of man he was. A player, like Philip. A man who wore his sexuality like a sport coat. Los Angeles was full of men like him. On several occasions, she'd fallen into their trap. When she was younger, of course. She wasn't surprised at all to see that one of his ears was pierced. She gave him a professional smile.
"Why don't you tell me about your patient? I understand the girl is, what, autistic?"
Surprise flickered across his handsome face. He reached down for a folder that lay on his desk.
"A diagnosis is your job. Adolescent minds are hardly my specialty."
"And what is your specialty?"
"Writing prescriptions, if I had to choose. I went to Catholic school."
That smile again.
"Thus, my penmanship is excellent."
She glanced at the framed diplomas that hung on his wall, expecting to see degrees from little-known, out-of-the-way schools. Instead, he had an undergraduate degree from Stanford and a medical degree from UCLA. She frowned. What in the world was this guy doing here? Running away. That had to be it. Rain Valley newcomers pretty much fell into two groups. People running away from something, and people running away from everything. She couldn't help wondering which category he fell into. She looked up suddenly and found him studying her closely. "Come with me," he said, taking her by the arm. Julia let him lead her down the wide, white hallway. Ellie was on his other side. After a few more turns, they came to a big picture window that showcased some kind of child care center. There they stopped. Max stood so close to Julia they were nearly touching. She took a step sideways to put space between them. The room beyond the glass was an ordinary-looking playroom with a small table and chairs, a wall of cubbies filled with toys and games and books, a sink and counter area, a row of empty cribs, and a hospital bed. "Where is she?" Max nodded. "Watch." In silence, they waited for something. Finally, a nurse walked past them and entered the playroom. She set a tray of food down on the table, then left. Julia was about to ask a question when she saw a flash of movement under the bed. She leaned forward. Her breath clouded the glass. She wiped it away impatiently and eased back. Fingers appeared beneath the bed, then a hand. After a few more long moments, a child crawled out from under the bed. She wore a faded hospital gown that was too big for her. The child, girl, had long, tangled black hair and deeply tanned skin. Even from this distance, the silvery network of scars along her arms and legs were visible. Her body was hunched over, as if she'd be more comfortable on all fours. After every step, she paused, going utterly still except for a quick, furtive cocking of her head. She sniffed the air, seeming to follow the scent to the food. Once there, at the table, she descended on the food like a wild animal. While she ate, she never relaxed, never stopped scanning the room and sniffing the air. Julia felt a chill move down her spine. She reached down and quietly opened her briefcase, pulling out a notepad and pen. As she observed the girl, she began making notes. "What do we know about her?" "Nothing," Ellie answered. "She just walked into town one day. Daisy Grimm thinks she came looking for food." "From which direction?" It was Max who answered. "From the woods." The woods. Julia remembered the Olympic National Forest. Hundreds of thousands of acres of mossy darkness. Much of it was still unexplored. It was the realm of myth and legend, where signs and wonders existed. Land of the Sasquatch. "We think she was lost there for a few days," Ellie said. Julia didn't respond. This was more than a lost day or two in the national park. "Has she spoken?" Max shook his head. "No. We don't think she understands us, either. She spends all her time under the bed. We bathed and diapered her when she was unconscious, but we haven't been able to get close enough to change the diapers. She's made no attempt to use the toilet." "Well," Julia said, feeling a rush of adrenaline, "let's see what we're dealing with, shall we?" She turned to her sister. "Go to the cafeteria. Get me a sampling of chocolates and fudges, also a slice of apple pie and a piece of chocolate cake." "Anything else?" "Dolls, lots of them. Preferably with clothes that come on and off, but not Barbies, cuddly dolls. And a stuffed animal. You said she was with a wolf pup, right? Get me a stuffed wolf."
"Gotcha.
Back in a bit." Ellie turned and hurried off. To Max, she said, "Tell me about those ligature marks on her ankle." "I think..." He was interrupted by the hospital intercom system paging him to the ER stat. He handed her the file. "It's all in here, Julia. And it isn't pretty. If you want to get together later to discuss..."
"The chart is fine for now, thank you."
She flipped open the folder and began reading. She barely noticed when Max left her. The entire first page was a catalog of the child's extensive scarring, including what appeared to be a poorly healed knife wound on her left shoulder. Max was right. Whatever had happened to this child, it wasn't pretty. 5. On leaving the hospital, Ellie wasn't surprised to find a crowd outside. They were standing in formation, like a landing party from a distant era, with the Grimm sisters positioned at the front in a loosely formed triangle. As always, Daisy was in the lead. Today, she wore a floral house dress beneath a heavy sweater. Green rubber boots ended an inch below her knees and 2 inches below the eyelet hem of the dress. Her dove-gray hair was pulled back into a bun so tight it caused her eyes to tilt slightly up. The ever-present Daisy necklace and earrings dwarfed her pale, wrinkled face.
"Chief Barton,"
Daisy said, moving regally forward, or at least as regally as one could move in rubber boots, carrying her dead husband's ashes in an urn. The Cowichan sweater she wore, a bulky gray and white Native American design, was at least 2 sizes too big.
"We heard you were headed this way."
"Ned saw you turn off the highway. He called Sandy, who saw you turn onto Bay Road,"
Violet said, nodding with each word as if the motion were necessary punctuation.
"What's the story, Chief?" someone yelled from the back of the crowd.
Ellie was pretty sure it was Mort Elzick, the local reporter who'd broken the story in this morning's paper.
"Hush, Mort,"
Daisy said sternly, using her former principal's voice to full effect.
"We've rallied the town, Chief, just like you ordered. Folks really came through. We have toys and books and games and clothes, even a scooter. That child will want for nothing. Shall I take them to her hospital room? Where is she, poor thing?"
Marigold stepped forward, lowering her voice as she said,
"Psych ward."
She glanced at the crowd around her, got them all nodding.
"On ER. They always get a consult from psych."
"What happened to the wolf?"
It was Mort again, trying now to push through the crowd. Suddenly, everyone was talking. Daisy couldn't stop them, and Ellie didn't try. They'd lose steam soon enough on their own. It was, after all, almost happy hour. One by one, they'd check their watches, mumble something, and head back to their cars. Daisy Grimm would lead the pack. No one could remember a day when she hadn't been at the Bigfoot Bar at the start of happy hour, with the black urn on the stool beside her. Half-price Boilermakers were her favorite poison. She proudly said that she never had more than 2. Or less.
"Who is she?"
Mort asked in a loud, exasperated voice. That shut everyone up.
That's the 64,000.